merriment, rather than happiness. These people, to a one, seemed to exist in a state of bland contentment. In these troubled times, maybe contentment was enough. But the universality of it, nonetheless, struck him as peculiar. He'd explored side streets, where houses were as assiduously maintained as the businesses on Lakeview Road. The entire town might be a movie set. If he were to open a door to one of the houses, would he find only a shell? No rooms within its walls? No furniture?
"You're going off the deep end," he warned himself.
But one more strangeness. He'd seen tourists on their smartphones, text messaging, and playing games, but not any employees or shop owners, either on or off duty, not anyone who appeared to be a resident of Iron Furnace. In a tech-obsessed society that wanted continuous social media contact, if anything confirmed an alien aspect to these people, their smartphone restraint was it. Luther hadn't expected to need a handgun. He still didn't think he would require one. However, counting on the traditional consideration given to high police officials when they carried concealed weapons into a jurisdiction other than their own, he had stowed in his suitcase a Springfield Armory super-tuned 45 Champion and a shoulder rig, plus two loaded magazines. Now he unpacked the pistol that he didn't expect to need, and he inserted a magazine. Again, he sat in the armchair, this time with the Journal of Cora's Fiction. He turned to the two-page fragment of repetitive sentences and fragments that he had discovered near the end of his flight from Minneapolis. As he studied her words, he glanced, occasionally, at the pistol on the table beside the chair. He was glad that he had brought it. Chapter 2. Harley Higgins hadn't gone to bed until 5:20 Monday morning. Even then, he lay in the grip of such anguish and dread. Exhaustion could not bear him into sleep. Although his parents weren't dead, they were in some nameless condition that consigned them to lives conducted according to the direction of someone or something else. If there was no way to undo whatever had been done to them, they were lost to him forever, and he might as well be an orphan. In 2 years, when he was made like them, he might be returned to their house to live, but he would not be truly Harley, and they would lead shadows of the lives they might have lived. They wouldn't be the walking dead, because they wouldn't be rotting and falling apart and all that, but they wouldn't really be living, either. And judging by the available evidence, they wouldn't know that they were changed, which was the most terrible thing of all. His captors must have realized he was unable to sleep, because Noreen came at 6:30 with a little special breakfast that consisted of a bear claw, a cinnamon pecan roll, and a glass of ice-cold milk. She insisted that the milk would help him sleep. There was probably a sedative in it. Harley didn't care. He had no interest in the pastries, but he drank the milk. He dreamed of a city where no one appeared to live. Abandoned office towers and apartment buildings without tenants, broad avenues deserted, stalled cars unoccupied in the streets, the silence of death blanketing all. But the people who didn't seem to be there anymore could still be seen reflected in store windows as they passed, in the polished steel facade of a trendy shop, in the surface of a pool in the park. Their presence was attested to by mirrors, but the people who cast those images could not be seen. Harley gazed out from a hotel lobby mirror, but he was invisible to himself when, standing before that reflection, he looked down at his body. When he understood that he lived only within the mirror, that he could no longer touch the world or be touched by it, his habitation limited to the thin plane between the glass and its silvery backing. He cried out in despair, but his cry produced no sound, as meaningless as the hopes of the dead and the desires of the never-born. 10 hours after drinking the milk, at 4:30 Monday afternoon, Harley woke and sat up and threw aside the covers and got out of bed and knew that he must try again to escape. Keep on trying, no matter how often he failed, until he died trying, or they locked him away. Chapter 3. Jane Hawk arrived in Bowling Green, Kentucky at 4:54 p.m. Monday afternoon, too tired to care that she ached in more places than not. She found a deli and bought 2 Reuben sandwiches and pickles and a container of potato salad. The motel was expensive, 4 stars and worth every one, offering a full array of cable channels, a universe of sense and nonsense. Sitting in front of the TV to eat, she wanted to watch only the Game Show Network, Family Feud with Steve Harvey, 3 reruns in a row. As long as the host mugged and joked, as long as the families feuded, it seemed something remained of the light-hearted, self-mocking, apolitical aspect of America that spoke so well of the nation's heart as it once had been in full, even if it might be fast withering now. After taking a shower, she carefully shampooed and conditioned and rinsed clean the wig in the sink. She put it on and shaped it to her head with blow-dryer and brush. Then she took it off and put it aside, and finished drying her own short, inexpertly self-cut hair. She took out the contact lenses that greened her eyes, rinsed them with solution, and stored them in a case. She stretched out in bed with the Colt 45 under the pillow where Nick would have rested his head if this had been a better world in which he still lived. She lay watching a ceiling she couldn't see, the dark pouring into her blue-eyed stare. And she asked only that when the darkness filled her for the night, it would lack the drama of dreams. Chapter 4. Harley received dinner in his quarters at 6 o'clock. This version of San Quentin provided room service. Each kid had a bedroom with king-size bed, a sitting area, and a full bath. But any place could be a prison if those who lived there were not free. For 10 months, he'd been stuck in this crazy place with these jailers who called themselves therapists. The weirdness, loneliness, and fear at times scraped his nerves raw. If he had instead been trapped in a nightmare, at least he would have awakened from it. He didn't know how much longer he could hold himself together. Something was coming apart inside him, unraveling, unplugging. His mind had always been a bright and busy place, but lately, some of the lights at the center seemed to be going out, so that sometimes he couldn't think clearly, couldn't see around that core blackness. When that happened, the sounds of this world became meaningless noise, people's voices, music, bird songs, like the racket of roller coaster wheels rocketing over buckled tracks. Then he needed to lie down, close his eyes, settle himself, and wait for the panic to pass. It always passed, but that didn't mean it always would. Some kids were in worse shape. The youngest 2, Sally Ingram, 7, and Nora Reinhardt, 8, shared a room because they feared being alone at night, and often in daylight. Jimmy Cole, 10, had been a fragile kid when this started, and last Christmas he had begun to withdraw. Now, he went days without speaking. Harley ate dinner by a window, overlooking the moonlit lake in the distance and the estate grounds to which the landscape lighting added a sinister magic. No barred windows, no locked doors. Inmates were allowed to roam the 5-acre property. A 9-foot stone wall surrounded the place, but it could be scaled where decades-old vines wove a lattice of handholds. Some trees stood close to the wall, sturdy branches overhanging it, providing routes of escape. At the north end of the estate, a wrought iron gate served a private pier, and the ironwork was easier to climb than the wall. The setup enticed Harley with the promise of deliverance from imprisonment, but the promise proved false. He was not the only one who had broken out, but failed to stay out. Their jailers must have some psychological purpose in tempting them. He wanted to believe that everyone on the staff was a rotten, vicious, egg-sucking snake, but they weren't. They seemed to be like his father and mother. Ordinary people somehow changed, so they were and weren't who they once had been. They went on with their lives as before, except when told to do something, even something freaky like giving up their children. And then they obeyed, without objection. Worse, they believed they were doing the right thing. None of the staff physically or verbally abused those in their custody, and in a weird way, they were always pleasant, almost kind. He wished they were complete zombies. Then he could have killed them. Sometimes he wanted to kill them anyway. But he knew that when it came to shoving the knife in, he couldn't do it. The jailers here weren't the rotten, vicious snakes. The snakes were whoever changed these people. Harley had theories, but they seemed stupid. He'd seen countless movies and TV shows about body-snatching ETs, mind-controlling ETs, evil artificial intelligences, murderous robots from the future, demonic possession. This could be any of those things. But if the real future was like a sci-fi movie, that would be insufferably dumb. Life was more complex than movies, needed to be more complex if it was going to be any fun at all. Besides, if the future took the shape of a sci-fi plot, there would be one scary difference between the movie and real life. In real life, no superstar hero could save the world from evil ETs. Armies couldn't defeat such enemies. If the vicious snakes in this case weren't people, humanity was screwed, and Harley would become one of them on his 16th birthday. He had to make another escape attempt. Soon. He figured there must be cameras, maybe hundreds, some obvious, others concealed. He supposed that the continuous streams of images from the cameras were analyzed in real time by software that could tell the difference between purposeful motion and the effects of the wind, that could also identify human heat signatures. When someone went over the wall, the system alerted the staff. Getting out of the estate didn't count as an escape, because the staff would be close behind you, but also because the entire population of Iron Furnace, 16 and older, had been replaced by imposters, or had been converted into mind-numbed worker bees. The first two times Harley skipped, he approached people he knew, thinking they would help him. Instead, they detained him until the so-called school could collect him and take him back to his room. The third time he escaped, he approached tourists for help. They thought he must be hoaxing them. Then they thought he must be mentally ill, which the staff from the so-called school confirmed when they showed up to get their disturbed young patient. He had to get all the way out of town, and he needed to tell his story in a more convincing way than he had managed with the tourists. He kept failing, but also learning. The previous night, having crossed the lake, when he came to Lakeview Road and saw the posse, he learned the most important thing yet. They might have hundreds of cameras and motion detectors, but they definitely had planted on him a GPS locator by which they could find him anywhere on Earth. After the father thing returned him here, Harley had stepped into the three-mirror nook in his walk-in closet, stripped naked, and examined himself, searching for a tiny scar that would betray a GPS implant. Maybe cameras watched from behind the mirrors. Maybe the snakes controlling everyone were pervs who enjoyed watching him. He didn't care. He needed to know if he had a surgically implanted transponder that betrayed his whereabouts. He couldn't find a scar. Finally, he had fallen into bed, exhausted. Now, as he finished dinner, he thought about his shoes. When he first realized something was wrong with his mom and dad, he had been transferred to this place while in a drugged sleep. When he woke, he found his clothes had been brought here from home, though not his shoes. No footwear was provided except for a new pair of sneakers. The previous night, after he'd grounded the rowboat and sloshed through ankle-deep water to the shore, after he had then climbed the meadow through the decomposed fruit of last autumn's mayapple, his sneakers hadn't been ruined, though they had needed to be cleaned. Instead, a new pair had been put in his closet. New. Maybe because the locator in the old pair was damaged. He was wearing the new sneakers now. His bathroom included a separate enclosure for the toilet, which he'd never seen anywhere else. They called it a water closet. If they thought the toilet should be hidden away and given a nicer name, they probably wouldn't put a camera there. At least, he hadn't been able to find one in that small space. He went in there now and closed the door and lowered the lid on the toilet seat and sat down and took off his sneakers. He inspected the left one from end to end, but he found nothing. In the rounded back of the heel on the right shoe, however, he discovered a circular indentation about half an inch in diameter, as if a core had been extracted from the rubber and something inserted in the hole, and then a cap of rubber glued over it. His dinner had come with a steak knife, which was pointed enough to dig out the cap and open the hole and reveal the locator. One problem. Maybe the thing couldn't be removed without damaging it. Then they would know that he had found it. As long as they remained unaware that he had discovered he was GPS'd, he had an advantage. Because he had slept most of the day, he didn't fall asleep until 2 o'clock a.m., which gave him plenty of time to work out an escape plan for Tuesday night. Chapter 5. Fading winter remained reluctant to make its peace with the coming spring. The weather was in flux from day to day, and Tuesday arrived cooler than Monday, corsair clouds having pirated the sun. Wearing long auburn hair and green eyes and horn-rimmed glasses with clear lenses, not wearing her wedding ring with its loving and incriminating words memorializing Nick's commitment to her, Jane drove through Iron Furnace shortly after 11 o'clock Tuesday morning. The town was enchanting, with marshaled evergreens towering over prime examples of American Victorian architecture. At the end of town, she turned west toward the resort. The lake was a smooth pool of pewter in the gray light of a sullen sky. Only two blue-canopied electric boats plied those waters, leaving wakes that melted away almost as they formed. She passed the resort. 2 miles farther stood the estate, owned by the limited liability company, Apiculus, its massive gate as forbidding as a castle portcullis. She cruised past, without slowing. A mile later, she came to a currently deserted scenic overlook with parking for several cars. She locked the Ford Escape, which contained her suitcases, handbag, and tote. Carrying binoculars, she crossed the road and entered a pine woods undergrown at first with ribbon grass and snowy woodrush not yet in flower, and then by ferns and spleenwort. The land climbed to an east-west ridge. She followed the crest eastward until pines gave way to witchgrass, whereupon she walked the southern slope, staying below the ridgeline to avoid being seen from Lakeview Road. Opposite the great house, she returned to the ridge crest and lay prone in the grass, from which tiny whiteflies riffled up and away to less contested vegetation. She adjusted the binoculars and glassed the property below, north of the road. Regarding the secret retreat of a man worth tens of billions, Jane expected not just the walled grounds and the formidable front gate, as existed, but also a gatehouse manned around the clock by at least one armed guard. There was no gatehouse, and the cap of the estate wall lacked the spear-point staves that would have been both decorative and, if sharp enough, a further impediment to entry. For a 5-acre property, the driveway should have been longer than this, though not for aesthetic reasons. A lengthy driveway gave guards more opportunities to stop an aggressive intruder who either blew down the gate with a package of explosives or rammed it with a fortified truck. Perhaps DJ Michael had nixed a gatehouse, a spearpoint wall cap, and other obvious defenses in order not to call undue attention to the property. He could have compensated for those omissions with greater electronic surveillance, armored doors, bullet-resistant glass, more than one panic room, and other security measures. At the moment, a man was sweeping dead leaves off the driveway where it curved under the receiving portico. He was dressed neither as a gardener nor in the black-and-white livery most common to the staff of a great house. Shirt to shoes, he wore only white, as if he were a dental hygienist or a hospital orderly. Jane pulled close on the windows, one after another, and found what she least expected on the second floor, at the pair of tall casement panes near the southeast corner of the house. A child. A boy, perhaps 9 or 10 years old. DJ Michael had never been married, had no offspring. He was an only child with no nieces or nephews. Yet here stood a boy, gazing out, tow-headed and pale beyond the glaze of window glass, his face not well discerned at that distance. He seemed solemn, though Jane might have been inferring a solemnity in him that matched her mood. Whatever he was feeling, his stillness was unnatural in one so young. She watched him for 3 minutes, four, and he moved only twice. First, to place the palm of one hand against the casement pane, as if some hummingbird or butterfly had ventured close and charmed him from his trance, and then to lower the hand and stand as before, with his arms at his sides. As she watched him, he seemed like a revenant rather than a real boy, some child ghost haunting a room where he had died, and she thought of Miles, the boy in the turn of the screw. A coldness with no source in the weather came over her there in the witch grass, because this boy also reminded her of Travis, who was younger, but likewise alone and beyond her reach. Even from her elevated vantage point, she could not see the first 40 or 60 feet behind the house, but thereafter she had a view of terraced lawns descending toward the north wall and a gate to the lake. Paving stone walkways wandered under specimen trees of several varieties that stood shadeless under the ashen sky. Some trees overhung the walls, which no security consultant would allow. Water spilled from scalloped bowl fountains, and a snow-white gazebo appeared to be as frosted with ornamentation as the fanciest wedding cake. Out from under the screening boughs of a willow, two little girls appeared on a winding path. Jane pulled them as close as the binoculars would allow. She couldn't see the girls well enough to be certain of their age, though they were surely younger than the boy, one smaller than the other. Walking hand in hand, an indefinable quality of their posture and pace suggested they must be downcast and somehow imperiled. But she might be imagining their mood, ascribing to them the threat that hung over Travis. She focused the binoculars once more on the casement window at the front of the house and found the boy gazing out as motionless as if he had never raised a hand to the glass. The sweeper of leaves had gone from the driveway. Behind the house, the girls had settled on a white-painted cast-iron bench forged with much filigree. They leaned against each other, like stricken sisters, each in need of sympathy. Beyond them, A woman came into view on the walkway that they had recently followed. Like the man sweeping the leaves out of the portico, she wore white from head to foot. She stopped at a distance from the girls and stood, watching them. With much cawing and a hollow, throaty rattle, a flock of crows came out of the east, following the two-lane blacktop as if they had been born from it. They arced from the road to the roof of the house, where they arrayed themselves along the peak. A second scanning of the windows revealed nothing other than the pale-faced boy standing as if at sentry duty. Suddenly, another boy, perhaps 14 or 15, appeared at the younger child's side and put an arm around his shoulders. The smaller boy stood unmoving until, after a minute or two, the newcomer led him away from the window into shadows and out of sight. Jane lowered the binoculars and backed off from the ridgeline and sat in the witchgrass, from which more white flies took flight on wings dusted with powdery wax. No bees had yet come into season, nor were there crickets already singing spring songs. If the estate on Lakeview Road had once been a secret retreat for David James Michael, it didn't appear to be one now. She had thought that Randall Larkin, shackled to a chair in the abandoned factory, had been too desperate to withhold anything from her. And she believed that DJ Michael owned this estate through an overseas trust, so the attorney hadn't entirely misinformed her. But the absence of armed security suggested that the billionaire was not in residence, and the presence of the children argued that the estate served some other purpose. Whether Larkin had expected her to kill him, or had thought only to squeeze one lie into all the truths he'd told her before flying off to a new life in the Caribbean, his purpose had been malevolent. She didn't think he would have sent her all this way merely to waste her time. More likely, this estate was in some way a trap waiting to spring, and the safest course was to walk away. She wanted DJ Michael, wanted to get him alone and break him and record his confession. But he wasn't here. She had no further reason to remain in Iron Furnace. Except. Both Berthold Schenick, father of the nanotech control mechanism, and DJ had links to this town, which suggested that learning the purpose of the estate might provide her with knowledge that would help her hang the billionaire. She got to her feet and dusted off her jeans and walked along the south slope of the ridge to the pine woods on her way back to the ford, considering approaches to the problem, while behind her the crows racketed off the roof of the mansion. If torn scraps of the previous night itself had snagged on trees and only now come loose, they would have been no blacker than these birds as they shrilled across the ridge and shrieked into the southwest, as though they must be a flock of prophets crying out an impending cataclysm. Chapter 6. The lovely concierge and event coordinator at Iron Furnace Lake Resort, Stacia Odell, had eyes the pale green of honeydew melon. She met Luther, posing as Martin Moses, event planner from Atlanta, at the front desk. When he claimed to be inquiring on behalf of a hedge fund that he was not at liberty to name, Stacia was pleased to show what the resort had to offer. She understood that cost was of no concern. Seeking a venue to host a 5-day bonding getaway for their 50 highest-tier executives, the principals of a hedge fund would find no price too steep. And when Martin Moses didn't at once offer a business card, Stacia had the grace not to ask for one, lest she be mistaken for doubting a clearly cultured, well-spoken, quite convincing black man solely because of his race. He said, "They tell me they want the Kentucky-Tennessee experience, as though Nashville and Louisville are cut from the same cloth. But we'll forgive them for their provincialism." Stacia smiled at his smile. "Well, one thing common to both Kentucky and Tennessee is legendary horses. We have stables here, and even those who've never ridden can be matched with a gentle mount. Everyone enjoys our escorted rides through some of the most beautiful scenery in the state.
Yes, I saw that on your website. A unique feature. The usual number one request is a golf course, and so it was this time, until yesterday when my clients informed me that a golf-centered retreat was old hat. They're interested in being adventurous. If only I'd known, I would have called you 2 weeks ago when I planned my itinerary.
Stacia conducted a tour of the premises, an average suite, the stunning Lakeview restaurant, the coffee shop with its striking Art Deco decor, a gym offering every conceivable resistance training machine, the conference rooms and banquet hall, an immense outdoor swimming pool, an even more magnificent indoor pool, the riding stables, as elegant as the hotel itself, the marina with its variety of boats, the tennis courts. Out of consideration for the guests currently making use of the men's and women's spas, Stacia couldn't show him those, but a handsome brochure folder, which her assistant had ready for him at the end of the tour, contained a DVD depicting the full range of spa services. During the tour, he had asked Stacia for a list of conferences and corporate retreats that had been held at the resort during the past 3 years, as well as any letters from the principals of those organizations that attested to their satisfaction with the experience. These, too, were in the folder she provided. As though a business card must be too déclassé for Martin Moses of the premier event planning firm A Private Affair, he presented to her a cream-colored place card with embossed borders on which only the 10 digits of an Atlanta phone number appeared in exquisite calligraphy. He had researched A Private Affair before leaving Minnesota, learned that Martin Moses was a partner, and had his multi-talented wife, Rebecca, calligraph the phone number on 6 blank place cards.
"Of course," he told Stacia. "I'll be out of the office until next Monday. I find these research trips exhausting, as you might imagine, and to keep myself sane while on the road, I simply refuse to let myself be constantly harassed by my cell phone."
"It's the devil's invention," Stacia O'Dell agreed.
"But I will certainly follow up with you early next week, Ms. O'Dell. And unless there's some Shangri-La out there I've yet to discover, I expect we'll be looking for an agreeable date when you have 50 rooms available. This resort, this town, it's like one of those beautiful bejeweled Fabergé eggs, isn't it? A mini paradise."
Chapter 7. Jane Hawke, at the wheel of the canopied electric boat, all but silently cruising across the quiet lake, the waters silver under the tarnished sky, parting for the prow with the faintest sibilance. At the moment, no one else abroad in a day too cool to encourage either fishing or exploration of the scenic shoreline. In addition to the marina at the resort, another operated in town. She had rented the boat there from a vendor who had explained the simple controls of the vessel and plied her with interesting facts about the history of the lake. Although he had been pleasant, even cheerful, and considerate of her as she'd boarded, something about him troubled her. She wondered if he might have recognized her in spite of the wig, contacts, and glasses. But as she motored away from the dock, he didn't produce a cell phone or hurry away to seek help, but stood for a minute, waving her off as though she were a friend rather than a tourist, and as if he genuinely cared that she should enjoy her touring. When she had cruised a mile, she decided that what seemed odd about him was nothing more than his enthusiasm in a job that most would have found tedious, especially on such a slow day, as well as a civility bordering on courtliness that she seldom encountered in this culture that grew ever more coarse. 2/3 of the way between the east and west shores, Jane arrived at the walled estate where the pier projected from its shoreside gate. She didn't slow, but motored on in case she might be a watcher watched. Nevertheless, sans binoculars, she studied this approach to the mansion. Half an hour later, on her return trip, she made less speed and dared to use the binoculars. A boy of perhaps 14 or 15 stood at the 9-foot-high pier gate, each fist wrapped around an iron picket, gazing between them at the lake. She thought he might be the same one who had appeared at the casement window beside the smaller boy and put an arm around his shoulders and led him away. He stood now as though he had contracted the younger child's melancholy trance, staring at the water as the other had gazed out the window. Jane wanted to steer the boat to the pier and tie it up and go to the gate and ask the boy, "What is this place? Are you all right?" Instead, she piloted the boat to the marina from which she had rented it, where the vendor was precisely as pleasant as he had been earlier. Then she set off to explore the town on foot. Chapter 8. A week prior to the event at the Veblen Hotel on Thursday, in anticipation of the tragic death of a fine governor and a beloved congressman and their admirers, Booth Hendrickson, a senior official of the U.S. Department of Justice and trusted associate of David James Michael, seated 8 operatives in town. Their task was to make certain that Cora Gunderson would obtain everything she needed and would stay on track to earn her place in history, but also to take firm control of the investigation in the immediate aftermath of the explosion and fire. By Sunday, the 8 were reduced to 3. They were assigned to be alert for loose ends that might unravel the operation and to tie them off at once upon discovering them. The senior agent in charge of this reduced contingent is Huey Darnell, who had called Cora a stupid skinny bitch to her face. At 46, Huey has gone through 3 wives, all harridans, and has sworn off matrimony. For the past year, he has been married only to booze, though he has concealed the intensity of this relationship from his employers. In the rapture of bourbon, he arrives at Tuesday with the conviction that he is on top of the situation, which is when he learns that Sheriff Luther Tillman has taken a week-long vacation beginning Monday, leaving Undersheriff Gunnar Torval in charge. He should at once report this development to Booth Hendrickson. But if there is an Asshole of the Year award, Hendrickson has shelves full of trophies. Although Hendrickson and Huey are simpatico when it comes to a vision for America's future, Huey prefers not to share his mishandling of the situation with his boss. Instead, beginning late Tuesday afternoon, he and the 2 men remaining in town with him, Hassan Zaghari and Kernan Beadle, take turns conducting surveillance of the Tillman residence from a series of suitable vehicles parked across the street and half a block away. They see the daughter, Jolie, arrive home from school, and shortly thereafter the wife steps out to get the mail from the street-side box. They don't get a glimpse of the sheriff in the first few hours of their watch, but he's probably watching sports on TV and drinking beer. Chapter 9. Harley Higgins spent the day preparing for the night. Operating under the theory that he was observed, he oscillated between 2 behaviors, sometimes prowling the house and grounds restlessly like a caged tiger agitated by the call of the wild, sometimes sitting slumped on a lawn bench as if depressed, or for long periods staring at the lake through the locked pier gate. He hoped to make them wonder if he was contemplating a dash for freedom by that route. He also spent time with each of the other 7 inmates, always contriving to make the encounters appear casual, always keeping them brief, because his theory of observation included the possibility that anything he said might be heard. He'd sat on the toilet in his water closet to print 2 messages on the palms of his hands with a felt-tip pen. His left palm announced, "Escape, 8 o'clock, library, no shoes." The plan continued on his right palm, "They track our shoes. Blink 3 if yes." All 7 blinked, and Harley felt that even Jimmy Cole, the most fragile of them, understood and would be there at 8 o'clock. Always in the past, Harley had chosen to make his break after midnight, when most of the staff had gone to sleep. If they had been monitoring his behavior all day, they might expect him to make a run for it later, according to his pattern, except by the pier gate this time. He decided on 8 o'clock instead, because most of the staff would be gathered in the main dining room for dinner. The inmates could move through the house with less chance of being seen. By conspiring to take the other 7 with him, he was putting the getaway at risk. It was easier to pull off a one-boy escape now that he knew about the shoes. Always before, however, his schemes had called for him to escape on foot, and it hadn't been practical to keep 7 other kids together with him through all the hazards that lay ahead. Now that he needed to plan for a barefoot breakout, going as a group was less challenging than it had been previously. Besides, he couldn't leave them in this place. Like him, they were coming apart inside, though faster than he was. He was also hopeful that if they could get out of town and to the cops, 8 of them would be harder to dismiss than 1. The police would have to listen to 8 and believe them. They would just have to. Chapter 10. Gallery to gift shop to t-shirt store to art glass shop to bakery, along residential streets and back to the main drag, Jane explored, not sure what she was seeking, compounding observations that might help her ascertain the nature of this town and what relation it had to the walled estate that stood miles from here. She was intrigued by the perfection of the crafted buildings and amazed at the cleanliness of everything. She marveled at the matched ranks of graceful trees and wondered about the scarcity of children and the apparent absence of dogs. As the cool day grew cooler and the clouds curdled darker, the light-sensitive solenoids controlling thousands of tiny low-wattage white bulbs on the trees brought a holiday glow to the street 2 hours ahead of twilight. An iron furnace showed why locals might call this the town where it's always Christmas. Jane stood on the sidewalk, looking north and south. Although the display dazzled, the effect on her was not Christmassy. Instead, she thought of the pulse and flash of Las Vegas, where the neon was meant to paint a veneer of glamour over the sordid truth of gambling addiction and financial self-destruction. These were Christmas lights as distraction, because in spite of its wholesome aspects, Iron Furnace had a dark vibe that she could feel, if not explain. Having skipped lunch, she went into an Italian restaurant at just 4:15 and was escorted to one of the empty high-backed booths. Phalanxes of red, white, and green flags hanging from the high ceiling, wall murals of historic sites in Rome, red and white checkered tablecloths, candles in red glass votives. They hadn't missed a decor cliché, but the place looked clean, and mouth-watering aromas threaded the air. According to the name embroidered on the display handkerchief in the pocket of the waitress's uniform blouse, her name was Freya, a pretty girl in her 20s, coffee and cream complexion spotted with cinnamon-colored freckles. She might have had both Ireland and Africa in her heritage. She was quick to smile and shared with her townspeople a demeanor that was pleasant and welcoming. Jane ordered a glass of good Chianti while studying the menu, and when Freya returned with the wine, she was willing to be chatted up here in the lull before the dinner rush. "Quite a town," Jane said. "It's just like a picture postcard, isn't it?"
"Totally. Have you lived here long?"
"All my life. I'll never move."
"No one would who's lived here."
"Never?
Wow. Never is a long time."
"Not an Iron Furnace. It's so nice here all the time. The days just go by lickety-split."
"If someone was thinking of moving here, you'd recommend it?"
"Oh, sure. Is it you thinking about it?"
"My boss. He visited last year, thinks he wants to move here if I can find him a place. He works from home. He can live anywhere.
Move from where? Freya asked.
Miami.
Miami must be real nice, huh? Palm trees and beaches.
Mosquitoes, killer humidity, flying cockroaches, Jane said.
Oh, you're just poking fun.
Maybe a little. My problem is, I don't see many suitable properties around here. I mean, for a guy with his expectations. I guess there's undeveloped land for sale. He could build a place. Freya shook her head.
Don't know from real estate. Lionel and me have a place his folks left him. Never did need to go looking.
Lucky you. It's no fun. Anyway, there's an estate out on Lakeview Road might suit my boss.
Estate?
Big old stone wall around it, right on the lake? That's the place. I drove past it and thought it might suit him. Ever hear of it being for sale? Freya frowned.
I don't think it would be. That's the school.
School? Oh. Someone said they thought it was owned by some mega-rich guy named David Michael.
Never heard of him.
It's been a school for a long time. Like a private school or something?
Something like, yeah. For kids with personality disorders, mental problems. They need therapy and teaching together.
That's sad, isn't it? Freya said.
Well, I guess maybe it would be sad if they weren't getting the help they are.
True enough. Poor kids. So much autism anymore. This school must be expensive, grand as it is.
I guess it would be. You know what you'd like for dinner?
Jane ordered a caprese salad, followed by a double order of the chicken marsala. Hold the side of pasta. Give me extra veggies.
We serve big portions, Freya warned.
Yeah, well, I'm eating for two.
Pregnant? Sorry for asking, but should you be having wine?
Not pregnant. I'm just eating for two. I always have.
Gee, and you have a real cute figure.
Crazy fast metabolism runs in my family. Plus, I'm wearing an industrial strength girdle. Freya laughed.
That's no girdle. You're as real as it gets.
After Freya served the salad and returned for the empty bowl, Jane said, I have a nephew with a personality disorder. Maybe that school would be good for him. But I didn't see any sign on it. You know the name of the place?
I don't, really.
That's funny, isn't it?
We just call it the school.
Don't worry about it. I'm sure I can look it up online. When Freya brought the double entree, she said, I warned you, we serve big portions.
Looks fabulous. Just smell that.
I might want a third.
Gee, if you were pregnant, I guess maybe you'd be eating for triplets.
I wish I were. I wouldn't mind, a bit, having a full house. You and Lionel have children?
No, and don't intend to, the way the world is, with all the horrible terrorism. Anyway, there's too many people already, and the climate changing.
Jane shrugged. The climate always changes, always has. I plan to have kids. Didn't notice any around here, except those with tourists. Town people here are mostly older. A lot of their kids are grown and gone. Not a lot of children around. Maybe it wouldn't be the best place for my kids when I have them.
You thinking of moving here too?
Jane smiled. I should have said, my boss is also my husband.
I suspect no one's the boss of you. Anyway, I hope you find a place. Be nice having you in town.
Later, after the waitress cleared the table and returned with the check, Jane said, Ben and I, Ben's my hubby, we're dog people. How do folks around here feel about dogs?
Dogs? Nobody doesn't like dogs.
I haven't noticed any, Jane said, as she counted out cash from her wallet, being generous with the tip.
Me and Lionel had one for a while. A yellow lab. I love labs, beautiful dogs. His name was Jules. But he got sick. There was this fever thing went around. It was terrible.
I don't like the sound of that.
Fever thing?
People lost their dogs.
I don't even like to think about it. But that's done and gone.
You're sure about that?
You could ask the vet over to Morning Dove if it worries you. His name's Dr. Wainwright.
Thank you, Freya. I might just do that. Wouldn't want to put our dogs at risk, their family.
I miss my jewels sometimes.
Nice meeting you, Freya. You take good care of Lionel.
I will.
I do.
You take care of the boss.
As Jane returned her wallet to her handbag and transferred her napkin from lap to table, a man got out of the booth behind hers and glanced at her and headed for the exit. He was tall, black, and dressed as if he were a little effete, maybe a college professor. But there was nothing effete about him. He was formidable, carrying himself with the confidence of someone who had been in tight corners and had always come out of them with just a scratch or two. The look he gave her appeared casual, though it was calculated, and his eyes were detail magnets, gathering in more at a glance than most people saw in a minute of study. She steeled herself for trouble. Chapter 11. When Jane stepped outside, the guy was standing by the nearest evergreen, backlit by its sparkle, waiting for her. There were no other pedestrians in the immediate area. He said,
"Excellent technique in there."
"Excuse me?"
"The waitress didn't realize you were grilling her. It all seemed like just easy girl talk."
"Because it was just easy girl talk. You have some wrong idea. It would be good to get it out of your head."
"Nice cut to that sport coat," he said. "Does the job."
If he knew her for some kind of cop, then he was some kind of cop himself. If he knew her for America's most wanted fugitive, he most likely wouldn't have been this cool. But his approach didn't make clear his intent.
"Earlier," he said, "I saw you in a gallery across the street. Heard you with the manager, drawing her out. You didn't see me."
"Troubles me that I didn't."
"Some of us hick sheriffs know how to run a surveillance."
He didn't sound Kentuckian. Wasn't in uniform. His coat was as tailored for concealed carry as hers. Though she figured she knew the answer, she asked, "You the sheriff here?"
"Hell no. The place creeps me out."
A young couple turned the corner hand in hand and walked toward them. The sheriff raised his voice and colored it with delight.
"You hardly look a day older. How long has it been? Is it 4 years?
"Just a little over 3, Jane said.
"How are Vernon and the kids?" he asked.
"We got Joey into that private school. Little Sarah is taking ballet lessons. Vernon, well, you know Vern. How's Hortense?"
"Our 25th anniversary is next month. She's planning some big to-do we can't afford. But I figure we'll make 26.
The couple had passed out of earshot. The sheriff lowered his voice.
"Once I saw you go in the restaurant, I went in by the back."
"For what purpose?"
"I wasn't sure. Curiosity."
She waited for him to ask who she was, what badge she carried. He didn't ask. She said, "Sheriff where?"
"Minnesota. Mostly a rural county. But you might have heard about some trouble we had there last week. 46 people dead."
"The woman in the fire wagon took down the governor."
"You didn't say crazy woman."
"How would I know if she was crazy or not?" He considered her. There must have been reflections of the tree lights in her eyes. There were no lights in his.
"Cora, the fire wagon woman, was a friend of mine for 20 years. She came here last August to a conference at the resort."
A conference about what?
Teaching special needs children. Something happened to her here. She was never the same after.
Something? What something?
It's chilly out here. If you can drink a second glass of wine and keep your edge, there's a tavern at the end of the block.
In this town? She said. I could drink a bottle and still be stone sober. His rental Chevy was parked at the curb nearby. On the way to the tavern, he stopped at the car, opened the trunk, and retrieved a spiral-bound notebook.
Some of Cora's fiction, he said.
She was a writer?
A damn good one.
I never heard of her. Until. As they continued toward the tavern, he said,
Emily Dickinson wrote hundreds of poems, only had 10 published in her lifetime.
It was maybe 6, I think.
Compared to Cora, Emily was a media superstar in her day.
So why does her fiction matter in all this?
She also wrote about something that was happening to her. She thought there was a spider in her head, laying eggs in her brain.
Jane halted. One of the suicides she had researched at the start of all this was a gifted 20-year-old woman named Portia, a software writer in an entrepreneurial partnership with Microsoft who'd had every reason to live. The goodbye note Portia left her parents was scored into Jane's memory. There is a spider in my brain. It talks to me.
What is it? The sheriff asked.
She turned to look behind them, half certain that they were being followed. There was no tail. She surveyed the street and the closed shops on the farther side of it. What she felt was not the threat of a lone observer, but the menace of place, as might be felt in Dachau or Auschwitz, in the Soviet gulags, and in the Khmer Rouge killing fields of Cambodia. She had felt it before. On an isolated farm where a pair of vicious sociopaths had raped and killed and buried 22 women in 5 years. With another agent dead and no hope of backup, she stalked and killed both men, taking the second down in a former hog pen that had years earlier begun to serve as a graveyard. 22 victims were buried there without markers, planted in that feces-rich ground as a final insult to their gender. Standing over the body of the man who had tortured and murdered them, she had, in some far recess of her mind, half heard the cries for mercy that had never been granted. And it had seemed to her that she was by some sixth sense aware of the sorrowful, mystical shapes that the bones of these martyred had assumed beneath where she stood, as the decomposition of flesh and the shifting of the earth had arranged them in a final piece. Now, the menace of place was a dark radiance under the bright surface of this town, which was not like a real town, but rather a diorama of an idealized village, which at any moment would be put under glass and preserved in a vacuum that allowed no life within these streets.
I need that wine, she told the sheriff.
Chapter 12. The tavern was a womb of soft shadows and softer lamplight, the air pleasantly scented with the draft beer that had spilled over the mugs and foamed away through the drain grill beneath the taps. The music was restricted to easy-listening country that celebrated love found as often as it did love lost, providing a comforting measure of sweet melancholy. In a high-backed booth at the rear of the room, where no one sat near enough to hear, Jane and Luther nursed their drinks while he talked about Cora Gunderson, her notebooks full of stories, her repetitious writing during which she revealed, clause by tortured clause, that a spider lived in her skull, the curiously curtailed FBI search of her house, the intense fire that consumed the place, and the visit by Booth Hendrickson of the Department of Justice, which convinced him that a cover-up was underway. Jane waited for him to ask who she was, for which agency she worked, but he unburdened himself as if she'd already won his trust. Finally, he put on the table the spiral-bound notebook taken from the trunk of his car. He opened it to a 2-page spread of precisely scripted cursive. Cora had